Good morning.
Good morning.
I saw all the bikers while walking up to Zen Center. It was quite a mixed crowd. Do you all know there's this bicycle around the lakes, biking around the lakes, and all the benefits go to the park system? It was really nice. Little kids. Oh. Old people. Oh, it was wonderful. So I have extra strong glasses today because I think this is as bright as the lights get, right? I have my power ones. So I'm Bonnie Bebunker, and some of you know my story, that I live in Maine. And so I'm not here all the time. But I'm here this year for 9 months as I'm doing a chaplain residency program at United Hospital in St. Paul. And last year, I was here for 6 months doing an internship at Fairview Southdale. And I'll use some of that material in my talk today. Originally, I was a student of Dinah Katagiri starting in 1979. And currently, I'm a student of Tim Burkett, the abbot here. And I'm very pleased to be here. So what I want to talk about today is something called watering the seeds of compassion. And ever since the Buddha's time, the intention of the followers of Buddha is to alleviate the suffering of all. And I want to share this Buddhist concept and some of the material and practices that Thich Nhat Hanh calls watering the seeds of compassion, alleviating the suffering of all. The intention to relieve suffering of all sentient beings rather than add to it. This is the central theme of Buddhism everywhere. So Jack Kornfield has a new book out. You know from my last talk that he's a favorite of mine. And he signed it because he was in Maine. And I had a simpler conversation with him. Hopefully I did not embarrass myself like I did the last time, which was really fun. So the title of this one is The Wise Heart, A Guide to the Universal Teachings of Buddhist Psychology. Excellent. Really excellent. So in the very beginning, he says these really simple things. He says, see the inner nobility. Nobility is a Greek word that means wisdom or inner illumination. See the inner nobility and beauty of all human beings. Then the next paragraph he says, compassion is a part of our nature. It's the deepest part of our nature. It arises from our interconnection with all beings. It's right there. It's right there. The practice of clarity of intention, repeating and remembering one's intention and practicing and acting on that intention to alleviate the suffering of all is the focus of Buddhist life everywhere, and watering the seeds of compassion is the path. Again from Jack's book. This is a Tibetan text from the Tibetan text Mahamudra. O nobly born, and again remember noble means wisdom or inner illumination. Hi. O nobly born, now there is born in you exceeding compassion for all those living creatures who have forgotten their true nature, including oneself, when we forget our true nature. I want to share with you one of the chants used by the Dalai Lama. He says he chants this daily, and every Tibetan monk chants this daily. And it's called the Eight Stanzas for Training the Mind, or Transforming the Mind. Daily recitation supports the remembering and encourages the focus of attention on your intention to practice deep compassion, intending to relieve all suffering. This is a powerful chant. It's so powerful that it's not in here. Would you do me a favor? Would you go upstairs to the office, and in the corner by the fireplace, there's a backpack. In the backpack is something that looks just like this, with a black clip on the top. It has the 8 stanzas for transforming the mind. Thank you very much. Thank you. What should we do while we wait? Let's see. I was surprised when I first heard the 8 stanzas because they're so, I don't know, intense. It's like I felt this incredible resistance come up in many of them, actually. It was, that's not possible. How could you do that? You know, all of this very natural resistance to something very strong. They're worded perfectly, of course, but very strong. So when someone can speak this sort of practice daily and then put it into practice, it has an incredible, powerful effect on your life. Many bows, many bows. Thank you. Okay, here they are, the 8 stanzas for training the mind. The first one. With a determination to accomplish the highest welfare for all sentient beings who surpass even a wish-granting jewel, I will learn to hold them supremely dear. The second one. Whenever I associate with others, I will learn to think of myself as the lowest among all and respectfully hold others to be supreme from the very depths of my heart. The third one. In all actions, I will learn to search into my mind, and as soon as an afflictive emotion arises, endangering myself or others, will firmly face and avert it. The fourth. I will learn to cherish beings of bad nature and those pressed by strong sins and sufferings, as if I had found a precious treasure very difficult to find. The fifth. When others, out of jealousy, treat me badly with abuse, slander, and so on, I will learn to take all loss and offer the victory to them. The next, the sixth. When one whom I have benefited with great hope unreasonably treats me very badly, I will learn to view that person as an excellent spiritual guide. In short, I will learn to offer to everyone without exception all help and happiness, directly and indirectly, and respectfully take upon myself all harm and suffering of my mothers. And the last one. I will learn to keep all these practices undefiled by the stains of the 8 worldly conceptions, and by understanding all phenomena like illusions, be released from the bondage of attachment. I'll say a little more. That's pretty much right there. And you all know the story of the Dalai Lama. I mean, some of this, you know, just you can feel whatever you felt, right, with these. But there is this story about the Dalai Lama being in this conference with all these teachers and leaders in the U.S. and someone, they were having question and answer, and someone asked, what do you do in Buddhism about low self-esteem? And the Dalai Lama conferred with his interpreter. No. And he conferred some more, about 15 minutes. They were going back and forth. And finally, the Dalai Lama says, "Do any of you in the whole audience have this problem?" All the hands go up. And he says, "Never heard of it. We don't have that." So, many people have the practice of making an intention. There's life intentions. There's New Year's intentions. People make daily intentions, moment-to-moment intentions. And many spiritual traditions also have this intention to create and foster loving-kindness. So the practice of making intention is done by many, many, many people. And you can even see it in bumper stickers. I see it at the bottom of emails now. It's like the classic one is loving-kindness. And then I've seen just be kind. And there's life is short, be kind. Or there's no choice but to be kind. So this is it's becoming a very pervasive thing in our culture. And the experience I want to share with you is the great opportunity I had to experience the value of practicing watering the seeds of compassion. It was critical for me last year and probably my entire life, but I was very aware of it last year, to develop a strong and many times a day practice. Last year for 6 months I was in a very wonderful immersion experience, although sometimes it felt like more like a pressure cooker than just immersion. And that experience completely supported and refined my intention to, if at all possible, alleviate suffering rather than cause more. So I was working with a group of chaplains and residents and intern chaplains. I was one of the interns, all with different spiritual traditions and all with this intention to relieve suffering for all. We were administering to the spiritual needs of the patient and the staff, also from all different spiritual traditions, while representing our own, and in my case, the Buddhist worldview. This was what's called CPE. I know you've possibly heard of it before, Clinical Pastoral Education. It was at Southdale Hospital, where one learns how to be a chaplain by being a chaplain. This sounds so Katagiri Roshi. How do you do it? His answer was always, by doing it. So there we were, being chaplains, and in this program, processing and reflecting on how we got in our own way. It was extremely enlightening. We looked deeply into how our baggage, our mind, our unconscious stories that we drag around or carry very tenderly with us gets in our way. Once conscious, can actually enhance our ability to live our intention to alleviate the suffering of all. Consciousness makes this huge difference, this change, which changes everything. Reflecting on our daily experience was half of the CPE program, with weekly oral and written group process and individual supervision and presentations. In addition, during those 6 months, I had the great privilege to be living here, where there are 4 meditation periods a day, if you want to take advantage of all of them, with that great opportunity to deeply observe the mind's movement and patterns. There are classes, morning and evening, weekly Dharma talks, monthly retreats, all kinds of students and teaching assistants practicing here, studying, volunteering, working, and Guy and his family even living here. I was in nirvana. And it was extremely challenging and demanding and focusing and exhilarating and exhausting because there was no place to hide. I could not avoid seeing my mind's activity. So I noticed a few things right off. The first thing I noticed was that I would hesitate going into patients' rooms. It's like my feet would go, but there was this lean to me as I was, going in. It was like, what's that about? And I realized I was still carrying the secondhand citizenship of being raised Catholic and female, where I was never going to be allowed to be this priest, this chaplain. Light on that one. And then I noticed I would hesitate to say I was a Zen Buddhist priest in this very Christian setting, Christian hospital, Christian Upper Midwest, Garrison Keillor Christian land. And it was because I had this fear, this contraction around being seen as too or being left out or just being ridiculed or not accepted. But there was this contraction around that. So that got some light on it. And actually, I started introducing myself thinking this was my way in was a raised Catholic Zen Buddhist priest. And then I found out that many Christians don't think Catholics are Christians. So that was a big shock. That was a surprise. So it didn't always help. I went into one room. Yes. Change the battery. Okay, I'll tell this you're doing that. I went into one. And the conversation went on from there. And it turned out to be a very good one. His wife was actually interested in bringing some world religion into her class. She taught in a Catholic school, in a Catholic grade school, and she wanted to know how to do it without getting into trouble. And I was like, oh my God, we're still there. We're still getting into trouble talking about world religion. And sometimes I would hear the voice in my head, which surprised me, and then it's like, oh, it surprised me that it surprised me. Judging patients by their diagnosis. Is that okay? I guess I didn't know I did that. So I'd look at the sheet and I'd see the diagnosis and I'd hear something in my head go, oh, I bet they could have done something to avoid that. Whoa. They're going to be happy to see me, right? Ooh. And then, of course, I became aware of prejudice. Judgment of others and myself. A lot of judgment of myself, too. I saw that I had favorites. I would look at my list and I would feel this prioritizing. Leaning towards these and not, well, maybe they're not in their room. Maybe, you know, and this leaning towards and leaning away, this greed and aversion. I saw it all. With the CPE program having reflection as the main component and Zen practice having observation, reflection, and mindfulness being the whole thing, there just wasn't any way I was going to slip through and not see all this. Having so much opportunity and requirement to be conscious and mindful of my thoughts, which when unconscious and unmindful quickly can become unskilled actions, rigid views, grasping, aversion, and on and on and on. It was impossible not to see at least some of my attachments to my precious dogmas, my old poor me's, my preferences, my judgments of myself and others, and prejudice. Nowhere to hide. Steeped in mindfulness, becoming aware of having my every thought and action being reflected, processed, looked at, and questioned, I needed to constantly increase my focus on compassion. To water the seeds of compassion for all. This all that is one includes oneself. When we really experience this oneness, We have no choice but to extend compassion to all of this, to all, including oneself. The well-being of one is the well-being of all. I began practicing what's called the Brahma Viharas. I'm sure it was Susan Nelson that suggested that to me. She did the program right before me. It's also called the Divine Abodes, the Sublime Attitudes, and it's known also as the Metta Sutra. So before going into those hospital rooms, those family rooms, the emergency room, the intensive care unit, or driving back to the hospital at midnight when you're on call and you're called in for you don't know what, you don't know how many grieving people are going to be there, you don't know whether their hearts are going to be open or they're holding them tight closed. This was such a privilege. This was such an immense privilege to do this work. Before doing all that, I would chant, "May all beings be happy. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering." I would chant it over and over and over again. And somehow, everything would turn and lift and open. And it was no longer a separate me doing anything. It just was this allness, this expansive allness. And this freedom of being, of just being, would fill the space. It was wonderful. I would chant this, pray this before attending patients or grieving families, before giving presentations or lectures. I chanted it coming down the stairs today. It helped a great deal. Before attending supervision sessions, coming home on the bus filled with Somali people and children and First Nation men. It was just wonderful. I would say this, the shortest of all versions of the Metta Sutra: may all beings be happy. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. It's short enough to remember. This focus, this prayer, this intention just opened everything up. Thich Nhat Hanh's Discourse from The Heart of Buddha's Teaching, one of his books, on the Metta Sutra. He refers to them as the four immeasurable minds. The practice of watering the seeds of compassion is as follows. The first one, there are four. The first one is limitless kindness towards all beings, with the wish that all sentient beings, without exception, be happy. The second one is limitless compassion towards those who are suffering, with the wish that all sentient beings, without exception, be free from suffering. The third one is limitless joy over the salvation of others from suffering. Altruistic joy is in the accomplishments of oneself and others, with a wholesome attitude of rejoicing in the happiness and virtues of all sentient beings. And limitless equanimity toward friend and foe, accepting both loss and gain, praise and blame, success and failure, with detachment, equally for oneself and for others. Not to distinguish between friend, foe, or stranger, but regard every sentient being as equal. Equanimity is a clear-minded, tranquil state, not being overpowered by delusions, mental dullness, or agitation. We all know that the seeds that we water, the seeds that we feed, the seeds that we give attention and intention to are the ones that will grow. They will bloom in our hearts, in our minds, and in our actions. We actually chant the full Metta Sutra or just a version of the Metta Sutra in our formal, the full one? Formal service. It's quite nice. And you can hear the limitless intentions in it very clearly. Thich Nhat Hanh says, is anyone else as warm as I am? No, Thich Nhat Hanh doesn't say that. That's me, yeah? Occasionally he's fanning himself. He says that all these seeds of compassion are already in us, right alongside all the seeds of affliction, greed, anger, and delusion. They're all there already in everyone. So then my questions start popping up. Well, how can we be aware of what seeds we're watering? And, well, okay then, how can we be aware sooner of what seeds we're watering? And the classic is, how do we practice watering the seeds of compassion? And, of course, Katagiri Roshi's answer is by watering the seeds of compassion. That's his beautiful classic. But Thich Nhat Hanh has four behaviors that support this practice. Stopping, calming, resting, and healing. And stopping is, of course, fundamental. And that is what meditation is all about. If we cannot stop, we cannot have insight. And stopping the body allows us to more easily see when the mind moves. Noticing the mind's movement is more challenging if our bodies are moving. Even in walking meditation, it's a different meditation. It's a different because something actually very, very much is actually going on. The energy of mindfulness is necessary in this stopping to recognize strong emotions, compassionately meet it with strength and clarity, and be present with that, what he calls a habit energy, our ingrained response to things each time it arises. Refrain from action until we are calm. Stopping and breathing deeply allows calm, which is already there, to arise. Now, I remember in one lecture, the abbot here, Tim Burkett, suggested that if we're having a problem with someone, we should wait 3 days to talk to them about it. Not 3 seconds, and not count to 10, but 3 days. And you should meditate before doing this, because we need to be stable, breathing and noticing our body and mind. And Thich Nhat Hanh, he's really good with these numbers, has 5 stages of calming. I love this. The first stage is recognition. You have to know that you're not calm. The second is acceptance. You have to accept what's right there in front of you. It already is there. And the no, I shouldn't be feeling this way is not helpful. You just accept that it's there and then embrace it. Ah, here's my old friend. Here's my old habit energy. Then looking deeply, and then insight has a chance to arise. Insight also is already there. Calming leads to resting, and they work very close together. We must learn to rest, and some of us coming from very hard-working Midwestern farm families, resting is like what Dad did on the living room floor 10 minutes after lunch, and that was it. The resting position in yoga, I believe, is everybody's favorite. It's my favorite. Could stay there forever. Thich Nhat Hanh says that with sitting meditation, we can allow ourselves to rest, just like if you're throwing a pebble into the river, and it just sinks down to the bottom and rests there while the whole river just passes over. And Suzuki Roshi has talked about meditation as a time for the mind to rest. And lying down is not the only resting position. Sitting meditation and slow walking meditation is also a time for rest. Calming leads to rest, and rest is necessary for healing. Thich Nhat Hanh uses the example of wild animals for healing. When they're hurt, they know exactly what to do. They go into the forest and they rest. And that's all they do. They just don't even think about anything else, just resting. That's how they heal. So don't struggle. Be like a wounded animal and rest. Just rest. Our body and mind have the capacity to heal themselves if we allow them to truly rest. Watering the seeds of compassion for all beings, including ourselves, is a life-supporting practice. And I encourage you to do it in any way that feels true to you. Let it enhance your heart's intention to not harm. Let it carry you. Let compassion open the way. I want to read one more thing from Jack's book, my friend Jack. And this is from the Sufi tradition. And this kind of blew my socks off, as you can tell. They're gone. Overcome any bitterness because you were not up to the magnitude of the pain entrusted to you. That's what blew my socks off. Overcome the bitterness because you were not up to the magnitude of the pain entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in your heart, you are sharing in the totality of this pain and are called upon to meet it in compassion and joy instead of self-pity. And this little beautiful card with a fiery, fiery dragon on it, with a saying or a quote or probably from a lecture from Katagiri Roshi, appeared yesterday. And I knew it needed to come along. So I want to end with this. All sentient beings are allowed to live and are from the beginning forgiven for living their lives in this world. All sentient beings are allowed to live and are from the beginning forgiven for living their lives in this world. Everything, whatever it is, has some reason why it exists. Evil, good, even something neither evil nor good. You cannot destroy devils just because you don't like them. Even though you don't like monsters, still there is some reason why they exist. Everything is entitled to live in the world in peace and harmony beyond our judgment, our evaluation. This is the first condition we have to realize. Everything is Buddha. I have no idea if there's time for comments or questions.
There is?
Okay. I'm open to comments or questions. Who is the they?
Everyone.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. When will they accept euthanasia? Is the question. And I have no idea. Other people might have some.
You think the doctors give enough medication to the people?
I don't know that. I see a lot of suffering, and I don't know. I've heard hospice nurses, not here in this practice, but in other practices, say that they don't want the final dose of lethal morphine to come from them. I think it's a very complicated and difficult question. I don't know how they judge. You're welcome.
Bonnie, how have you worked with the SAR?
The 8 stanzas for training the mind? Do you think what's possible?
Do you think it's possible to do that? Because in the beginning, you thought that you said, no, you can't continue to do that.
Did I say that? Well, the Dalai Lama does it. He chants it every day. Tibetan monks chant it every day. I have had a practice of chanting it every day. And it does, it's like, an intention is like, it's like a trip, going on a road trip. It's not the road. It's not the car. It's not the map. It's not the destination, but it's the direction you're pointed in, maybe? So I think, and some of these I think are extremely challenging. And, you know, I really felt in myself this, you know. That's all there was, no words, just what I do know about it is that a daily chanting practice of one's intention kind of is like misting or something. And it can stay with you much longer. Like any of the chants that we do or any of the tensions you have when you walk out the door. I think it's a very, very powerful practice. Even if I'm going to pay attention driving or I'm going to not give anybody the finger today. Or, you know, I mean, it can be really basic stuff. But it kind of sets you in a certain direction. Does that answer at all? Or does that address your question?
It opens you up to the idea that you could possibly, that there'd be something that could permeate
life. Yeah. Because while we're listening to the news and the radio and the television and all that, we're getting lots of ideas of all kinds of things we might not want to choose to develop in our life, attitudes or ways of responding to situations, all kinds of things. So I think having a practice of deciding what intentions you want in your life, what you want to develop, what you want to water, is a good practice. It's a very helpful practice. Yeah. It changed things like that. And I didn't know it would. I just knew I had to do something. And that's the only one I remember because it's really short. You know. And then I used it all the time and it just changed everything. That's why I mentioned that. Because this isn't a low self-esteem issue. And it for the concept to not even be in his experience was very telling in that culture. I remember working with someone at the University of Wisconsin when I was there. I think I was a TA and he was a professor of something. And I was working with kids coming in with all kinds of challenges for being successful in college. And this professor kind of ran the program. And he was from South America somewhere. And he said, this is so confusing to me. Why these people have such challenges, knowing that they are worthy, knowing that they're, you know, and it's like, and the parents are so demanding and pushing and not rejoicing in who they are. He said, in my country, and he had his little daughter sitting on his lap on that, he said, in my country, once you're born, that's it. You're a complete success. You don't have to do another thing. And that was like, that would be really interesting. So cultural differences. Yeah. So when you read this, when I read this the first time, that's what came up for me. What? More of that? No. But it's not more of that. It's a totally, it's a totally different view of it. Does that address your question?
Actually, my comment was on the exact same thing, and maybe extending it a bit would be not putting somebody above below, but in relation to. So, you know, to say, why do we need to put ourselves below somebody else to show honor to them, or to their beingness, or whatever that's speaking to it, rather than being in, you know, equal relation to.
I don't know. I would say that would be a wonderful question for you to work with, sit with, you know, kind of find out where the question comes from. What is?
Well, I'm guessing it's probably coming from the exact same place, you know, the self-esteem stuff.
Yeah, but to keep looking at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard the Dalai Lama story before, and when you started to tell it, I thought his answer was going to be, well, promoted.
I saw you smiling greatly with that one. Yeah, I mean, he didn't even understand how that was possible. I could make some copies and bring them down for you. Yeah. You're welcome. And I don't have a watch.
Okay.
So I'll leave it to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Many bows. Great gratitude. Thank you.